If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. Critically analyzing national affairs.
David Curtin.
You're with David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
It's 1 week till local and London elections in England. There will actually be elections everywhere in England and Wales because there are police and crime commissioner elections, which are not very much spoken about. So wherever you are, you will have a vote on something. Unfortunately, in most of the police and crime commissioner elections, you only have a choice of uniparty candidates, Tory, Labour, Lib Dem and Green, because the entry fee to enter those contests is £10,000. And there are 42 of them. So it's very, very prohibitive to independents and challenger parties. Of course, though, the main focus is on the London mayor election, which is one of 10 regional mayor elections which is taking place. But of course, the London mayor has the highest profile in the nation and in the mainstream media. And we've had Sadiq Khan for the last 8 years. Before that, we had 8 years of Boris Johnson. Before that, we had 8 years of Ken Livingstone. None of them particularly good, but we have had a disaster really in the last 8 years with Sadiq Khan in London with his pursuit of wokery and the climate alarmist agenda. Now, he seemed to be running away in the polls as the outright winner, almost unchallenged. But there has been a slight comeback by the fake Conservative candidate, Susan Hoare, who is now 13 points behind him, whereas she was 24 points behind him a couple of weeks ago. This is quite a significant change in the polls, and it seems to be that she has gained at the expense of Reform UK, this hapless fake challenger party that's really just a Tory pressure valve, in my opinion. Now, this doesn't mean that she's going to win. This not much of a change. There are some differences between the two. Obviously, Sadiq Khan is pushing pay-per-mile road charging. He's introduced the ULEZ last year in outer London, which is affecting also the people who are commuters and businessmen and women who need to drive into greater London from counties surrounding it. But she still says that she's going to keep the ULEZ in inner London. And she still says she's going to keep all the surveillance cameras there for police surveillance so that we can be surveilled 24/7 for our safety and security. No doubt attached to AI facial recognition technology in the future, which a report said yesterday is being pushed in the UK without any regulation and far, far more advanced in the UK than in countries on the continent of Europe who are much more reticent to employ AI facial recognition technology and allow the police and security forces to have access to it. It seems that we are an aberration in the UK that is going all the way, fast streaming ourselves down the road to surveillance hell. Now, both Labour and the fake Conservative parties and the Lib Dems and the Greens support this. So we shall see what happens in the London elections in just 6 days' time. It's very interesting as well because there are other polls coming out from other races as well. The next most significant race is the race for the West Midlands mayor, which of course includes the cities of Birmingham, Coventry, Wolverhampton and the surrounding metropolitan areas, a very, very large area. Last time, the fake Conservative candidate won because it was in the same year as the last general election. A year after the last general election. And they were riding high with Boris Johnson having won, promising to get Brexit done. So that was the point at which they'd overturned the Red Wall. Now the Red Wall is being rebuilt, not so much because Labour are inspiring, but because support for the fake Conservative Party has collapsed because they have been proven to be an absolute disaster in every single area, not least the area of immigration and also areas of the economy, not fighting against wokery, in fact, encouraging wokery and destroying our education system quite thoroughly at the grassroots level, with children not being allowed to go to school for lots of for a long period in the lockdowns, and also introducing these subjects like RSE. We hear also that in the international PISA test results of mathematics, reading and writing, England is falling well behind other countries such as China, who are laughing at us because we are no longer pursuing excellence. While they are teaching 13-year-olds about advanced calculus, we're teaching children of the same age about neo-pronouns and how to be a furry. This is really not going to do our children much good in the future. And it's all happening on the watch of the fake Conservative Party. In the West Midlands back there, the candidate for the fake Conservative Party has a strong personal following. But even that doesn't seem to be doing him enough to get him back in. The latest polls show him 6 points behind the Labour candidate, despite his good personal standing in the area. It doesn't look like he's going to get back in. We shall see what happens after these elections next week. Of course, what really counts is not these polls that we get. This is just a little bit of fun for the pundits and the newspapers to sell stories. But what really matters is what people do when they get in the ballot box on the day. In London, in the West Midlands, around the country, we shall see what happens. And it's certainly going to be a day of reckoning for Rishi Sunak and his party. And who knows what is going to happen with them calling a general election sooner or later after the day. We shall see. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Gemma Cooper is here with me on the David Curtin Show to talk about the latest in the UK's news headlines. Welcome, Gemma. What's going on today?
Well, quite a few headlines to bring to the table here in the UK, here on TNT at the top of this hour. But just, you know, just hearing you talk there, I do think that these elections, local and general, will be extremely interesting, because there was this huge YouGov poll done only this week, the results of which was this week. And it said that only half of British voting electorate have no faith now in any of the political parties. When questioned, they said, you know, do you have faith that that anyone in power will put your interest, people's interest, the people that vote them in, over the party or personal interest of the MP concerned? And they said, absolutely not. Half of the population in the UK, what have we got in the UK? 68 million people. Obviously, not all of those are eligible to vote, but half of the electorate questioned said, nope, not anymore, not since 2020. Don't trust any of them. They're just in it for themselves. And I think that that is a mood that we will see reflected in the amount of people that actually bother to turn out. Or maybe people will just be turning out and voting for the more fringe independent. I know there's a lot of people from the freedom movement that have started standing, especially on a local level, in elections. So it is going to be a very interesting look at how the political landscape has shifted since 2019 and all the things that happened since then, revealing corruption in power, corruption by governments, you know, the absolute disdain in which they hold the people at the bottom. Let's see what happens. A very interesting week next week. Very interesting.
Yes, certainly is. And I think there's 46 million or so in the electorate. But yet in the local elections, turnout is notoriously low anyway. I think even in the London mayor elections last year, the most important of these elections that happens on this day every 4 years, it was 3 years ago, actually, because of COVID, the turnout was just about 45%, which means 55% didn't bother to vote. I wonder if turnout is going to be even lower this year. I mean, you say 50%. Are fed up with all the parties in Parliament. Now, that would sort of probably indicate what would happen in a general election. But then turnout in local elections is often a third to a half lower than in general elections. So I wonder if the average turnout is going to be just something like 30%, you know, which is in line with what happens in by-elections, in local elections. And I really think people need to understand the importance of these elections. And a lot of people say to me, and have been saying to me this week and last week, oh, I got my ballot paper, you know, people have got postal votes and so on. They say, I've only got uniparty candidates. Who am I going to vote for? And I say, well, look, you can vote for you. Next time, stand yourself. Anyone can stand. It's not hard to do. You just need to get over the hurdle of filling in a few forms. But it's free to stand in county and district and borough elections. You know, obviously, we in the Heritage Party have got 34 candidates standing this year, which is the highest percentage we've ever got in the number of seats there are in local elections. But look, if you're fed up, get involved yourself. You can't leave it to other people. I was thinking about this morning. And there are something like 25,000 seats available at county and borough and district level. So, you know, there's more seats than people, if you like. And in a town and parish level, there's over 100,000. So, you know, really, you can get involved and there's room for everybody to be involved in the political process. We need you to do that rather than just, you know, leave it to the uniparty.
Very well said. And it would be interesting to see how the shift in people trying to take power back for themselves, that's been a big theme of the last 4 years, how that translates into who does end up standing and forming their own different alliances and the politics and the policies that they stand for, you know, speaking truth to power rather than being assimilated into power. So, yeah, very interesting. Headline-wise this morning, well, politics dominate. It's Scotland again, Humza Yousaf. He was supposed to give a speech today in Glasgow at Strathclyde University, all about independence, but he's cancelled that speech, leading to speculation, and it is speculation, that he might even resign today after breaking the power-sharing agreement with the Green Party yesterday, only previously 2 days ago. He said how he loved the Bute House agreement, how it was a solid arrangement, and then he broke it. He broke up with the Greens. It's all gone a bit wrong for him. He's cancelled a public appearance. He was supposed to be doing questions and answers in a few hours' time. That's all gone. Speculation mounting. He's facing a no-confidence vote next week as well. The leader of the Tories and Conservatives yesterday in Scotland said they would put that motion forward. And of course, he's in a minority government now. He's not power-sharing with the Greens. So if everybody unites against him, that vote won't go the way he wants. So we're keeping an eye on that story. He may yet stand down. Also, two men are appearing in Folkestone Magistrates Court in the south of England this morning, charged in connection with the five deaths in the English Channel earlier in the week. The migrant boat that came over, packed with people, five people, including a seven-year-old girl, ended up drowning, washed up on a beach in northern France. There are reports prior to the charges that the boat was stormed by a rival gang of migrants armed with knives, and that's one of the reasons they were fighting with each other. The boat was overcrowded. That's one of the witness accounts that was on the boat. And also, just another story, post-2020, is the UK turning into a nation of slobs? It would seem so. Research out today shows that activity levels in 16 to 34-year-olds, you know, the youngest and supposedly fittest generation, have never gone back to pre-pandemic levels, never gone back to pre-2020. The only people doing any exercise now in Britain is the over 75s, the survey suggests. So another lasting legacy of what happened in 2020 and how it's affecting the nation's health as a whole there, David.
Well, the story from Scotland interests me, you know, very much, obviously, because I'm in politics myself. And this is a really fast moving event, isn't it? With yesterday, the agreement between the SNP and the Greens falling apart, then the no confidence vote being called by the leader of the Scottish Conservatives, and then Humza Yousaf today pulling out of appearances. And all the rumours are that he's going to stand down today. I mean, we don't know. They're just rumours. But, you know, sometimes rumours have some truth to them. But it looks like he's going to be gone, whether it's today or whether it's next Wednesday, with a vote. And that's very interesting, because what happens if the First Minister loses a vote of no confidence? I mean, I'm reading reports about this, and they say that, well, it's not you know, obligatory for him to resign if there is a vote of no confidence, but he probably would do. I mean, which seems a little bit strange to me, because if there's a vote of no confidence in him, well, you would think that resignation or he would automatically be removed from that position. I mean, what's the situation? Is there, does he have to go, or is that, does that then open the way for a vote of no confidence in the government and then a new election in Holyrood?
Possibly both, I think. I mean, it's rare that any kind of senior figure facing a no confidence vote, which they lose, does stay in post in any organisation, whether you're a manager or a chief executive. It doesn't normally work like that. I mean, I just did a little kind of look on social media just to gauge what people were saying. And some people were saying, oh, we're going to have Nicola Sturgeon back before you know it. You know, and of course, that would be disaster because her husband, Peter Murrell, has been charged with embezzlement of funds relating to the SNP. We can't say more about that. It's the Court Proceedings Act. But, you know, the SNP, it's never looked worse, has it, for the party as a whole? And now, of course, they have the minority. The whole reason they went in with the Greens was they didn't have enough MPs for a majority government. And so both pro-independence parties decided to work together. So it's all crumbling. But I think it is significant. You know, he's supposed to give this speech at the University of Strathclyde, all about Scottish independence. You know, if he was had the courage of his convictions of yesterday, breaking the Bute House agreement, you would think he would walk onto that stage very proud, you know, very in control of his actions, you know, no need to defend himself. I feel I did the right thing. You know, a political act, effectively, of standing up for his actions. But no, he's kind of scurried away, cancelled a public appearance where he was going to take questions. What is going on? And what will the ramifications be? Quite right to ask. It's a very unusual situation in an election year. You know, will we have another two elections running alongside? What will happen? Will Nicola Sturgeon come back? I mean, we've had dodgy Dave Cameron back in the cabinet. No one saw that coming in London. So who knows? Who knows what will happen? But certainly it's a fast moving story, as you say.
Who knows? Who knows indeed? We shall see what happens. I hope that they will crumble and fall away, because they've been a disaster to Scotland, for Scotland. And really, I think the Scottish people deserve far, far better than Nicola Sturgeon, Humza Yousaf, or anyone in the SNP, or indeed the Scottish Greens, who are pushing their radical climate and transgender agenda. I don't think people realise that about them, but that's what they are. Anyway, Gemma, thank you so much for bringing those stories and the headlines for us today on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT's Jason Allbourne.
In today's Australian newspaper, a horrific hit piece was delivered against Julian Assange, with the headline "Assange's Sordid Tale of Treachery." It reads, "Julian Assange is a criminal, a fabulist, and an undisciplined, arrogant, workshy fraud who lacks an education while remaining a mannerless vulgarian." The WikiLeaks founder is no journalist. Well, that's Alan Howe taking no prisoners, himself a history and obituaries editor, deciding to write a 9-minute piece to basically pull apart a fellow Australian as he tries to get out of prison, where he's been locked up for 5 years in maximum security for the work of being a journalist.
Weekends with Jason Allbourne on today's News Talk TNT.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Facts and truth.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Look her in the eyes and tell her the risk isn't real. That was one of a number of hard-hitting adverts that the government put out in the time of lockdowns and COVID in order to try to get people to stay at home and to adhere to the totalitarian and tyrannical COVID regulations they put in place. I think we all now realize that there was something very, very wrong with what was going on there. But Gary Sidley is with me today, and he is the co-founder of the Smile Free campaign, opposed to mask mandates that were in place there. He's a former NHS consultant, clinical psychologist, and the author of Tales from the Madhouse and a member of HEART. You do so much, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me on. Pleased to be here.
Right. It's great to have you on. Great to have you on the show, Gary. And you've been doing some research into these adverts and into the behavioral psychology that was used. I mean, what are the main things that you found out about who was making these adverts and why they were being done?
Wow, that's a big question. Yes, my interest was in who was actually behind a lot of these really harrowing adverts during the COVID event, or who was responsible for them, because a lot of people have denied using fear and guilt. Of a prominent behavioral scientist saying it wasn't them. So since July of last year, I've been conducting a research project trying to find out who was responsible. And what it's done is, amongst other things, it's demonstrated that, first of all, behavioral science is everywhere. People would be really surprised, I think, to know just how pervasive this kind of psychological manipulation is. It's in every department. It influences every walk of our life. But specifically, what I also found is that there were four key players with regards to the look them in the eyes adverts. We focused on the look them in the eyes because it was generally accepted to be the most ethically dubious and the most harrowing set of adverts. And what we found was that there were four key players. I can go through them if you like. One of them was Conrad Bird, who's a senior civil servant. His formal title is Director of Campaigns and Marketing at the Cabinet Office. That's his title. He was the person who was involved in putting this together from the civil service point of view. He's very proud of his work. He thinks it was a kind of a life-saving operation, virtually, using adverts like this. So he was the main civil servant. We also found that the Cabinet Office behavioral scientists, the Cabinet Office nudges, were the formal source of behavioral science guidance for that particular set of adverts, which was a little bit surprising, David, because obviously the most visible nudges, the most visible behavioral scientists were like part of the SPIB SAGE subgroup. And the nudge unit, the behavioral insight team. But on this occasion, it didn't seem that those were directly involved in this particular enterprise. It was a smaller group of behavioral scientists located in the Cabinet Office who had the responsibility.
I mean, this is astonishing because, you know, the Cabinet Office is just something I think people just think, well, they're people that help the government to do this. I mean, but no one really knows what the Cabinet Office does. Well, I'm sure some people do, but it's just something that is sort of sitting there you think is fairly benign and just, you know, helping out with administration. But here you've got these people actively trying to manipulate our behavior right in the heart of, I guess, right in the heart of 10 Downing Street. I mean, how does that actually work with the Cabinet Office doing this?
Well, in this instance, it was apparently, according to our Freedom of Information request, it was the Cabinet Office behavioral scientists, which is a small group, less than five individuals based in the Cabinet Office, who were advising Conrad Bird, the senior civil servant, about his, you know, in his negotiations with the advertising company, which in this case was Mullen Law, who incidentally received, I think it was almost £50 million within a couple of years of the COVID event to put things together. So it's quite a lucrative business. So what they do is they advise on how they can use these covert, often covert methods of persuasion. Now, when they look them in the eyes adverts, there were lots of nudges. You know, nudges, by the way, if people aren't aware of these psychological strategies of persuasion, which often act on their targets below the level of consciousness. So people don't know that they're being influenced, essentially, in a lot of cases. So what the behavioral scientists do is they instill these kinds of strategies into the videos and the posters and the mantras to get people essentially to do what the state wants them to do. And in the look them in the eyes, the most prominent, and there's lots of nudges in that, but the most prominent ones were fear inflation, of course, but also guilt and shaming, often referred to in the literature as affect nudge and ego nudge. So these adverts, you know, look them in the eyes and tell them that you're doing everything you can to stop the spread of coronavirus. Yeah, you know, and your close-ups, and you know, they were all given names to add to the intimacy of it, and so many tricks involved in that campaign. And essentially what it's trying to do is kind of say, look, if you're not following all our restrictions to the letter, you're not a good person. You're not virtuous. You're not, you know, the virtuous follow the rules, and you're responsible for, you know, if you're not following the rules, you're responsible for this carnage in the intensive care units. And that's a very, very powerful message, and I would say ethically highly dubious as well, to be using those kinds of techniques on a population, David, that at that time, we're talking January 21, at that time, we're already overly scared, we're already overly frightened, and then they're shaming and frightening them further with these kinds of adverts. And I think people should be aware of.
I totally agree with you, Gary. It was absolutely appalling for the government to do this. And, you know, you mentioned the specific strategies there, fear, guilt, and shame. We're going to have a quick news break now, but we'll come back in a minute and talk more about this and more about what they are actually doing and how we can become aware of this so that we are not so affected by it. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Question. Huh? What are you guys doing today?
The news.
TNT Radio News.
Sounds good.
Matt Boylant here with your TNT headlines. The UK has come under fire for refusing to condemn the killing of hundreds of civilians found dumped in mass graves in Gaza. Former US President Donald Trump stopped traffic in New York on Thursday as he made a surprise stop at a construction site on his way to court. And London has warned Ukraine will begin ramping up long-range strikes inside of Russia as it starts receiving more advanced weapons from the West.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Gary Sidley is with me here on the show today to talk about behavioral psychology, nudging, and specifically how the government and government agents used this in order to cause fear, cause guilt, cause shame, and cause other emotions in order to try to manipulate your behavior in the lockdown period. Now, Gary, we were talking about that earlier. You talked about some of the strategies, and what I was particularly disturbed by was when you were saying that the point of this is to get people to do things to affect people without them realizing that they're being affected, without them realizing they're being manipulated, that they try to work on the unconscious level below your consciousness. What are they still doing this today? You know, this campaign, you know, look her in the eyes, look him in the eyes is finished, but are they still doing this with other things today? I mean, because you mentioned that this is almost ubiquitous across government.
Yes, these strategies, incidentally, they exploit the fact that human beings are on automatic pilot. 99% of the time. We don't deliberate over our day-to-day decisions because that would be too cumbersome. It would take too long. So we're on automatic pilot making instant decisions. And they exploit that. They exploit those kinds of shortcuts and rules of thumb that we use. And the point you just raised, David, I think is probably the most important one, because people sometimes say to me, Gary, you know, you're looking at this COVID event, you know, and it's all in the rear mirror now. You know, these techniques, you know, it's over. That's not the case. These strategies are being used now in pretty much every aspect of our day-to-day lives and will be used again and again under some banner or other, whether it's another pandemic, whether it's a climate emergency, whether it's war, whether it's pollution, whatever the global leaders determine is a kind of crisis, these methods will be used. And whether we know, whether we're kind of making healthcare decisions, whether we're on transport, on public transport, whether we're filling in our tax form, no matter, every walk of our life is to some degree being furtively influenced by behavioral science, state-funded behavioral science. So taxpayers are paying for this as well. And personally, I think more and more people should be aware of that, that this is what's going on. We're being nudged, we're being furtively shaped in our behavior to follow what the government thinks is in the greater good or the socially responsible thing to do. And the more people that are aware of that, in my view, the more open dissent there's likely to be. My guess is that a lot of people will not like the idea that they're paying their own government to covertly influence them in virtually every area of their life.
I mean, the thing is here, I wouldn't think of doing this myself. I wouldn't even want to do this, even if I did know how to do it and I had the power to do it, because I don't want to manipulate people in this way. I mean, this is almost like a modern form of witchcraft in a way, isn't it? And sometimes you have these three-word spells that they put out. I mean, back to the lockdown, one of the things we saw over and over again was on a harsh red and yellow background, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, or hands, face, space. You know, these three concepts or three words. And apparently these really stick in your mind. And then they're just there, and they do affect your behavior because you're thinking about them all the time. I mean, would you agree with that? Is that something that is one of the techniques that they use?
Yeah, there's a whole raft of techniques, David, multiple techniques. It's quite confusing sometimes because they come under different sort of names. But the stay home, protect the NHS, save lives is also another nudge that uses like what we call the ego nudge. Again, equating following the rules with being a worthwhile, virtuous individual. So that is another example of the nudges that are used. And I think the people who use these, by and large, think they probably are doing good. And I'm sure that if we asked some of the more prominent behavioral scientists, they would say, well, we're doing this for the greater good. We're doing this for the world's populations. We're contributing to good outcomes. And the people who made, they look them in the eyes, they clearly think they did a great job. They actually claim to have saved many lives with that advert, which is highly dubious to say the least, of course.
Yeah.
Not least because it doesn't incorporate the collateral damage of a lot of these techniques. Using fear, for instance, inflating fear in an already frightened population does lead to its own types of carnage. You know, it's well documented. Fear kills. It kept people away from hospitals during the COVID event with non-COVID illnesses. They were too scared to go. They isolated people, particularly the elderly, and we know loneliness kills. That's a demonstrable fact in the research. Yeah. So there's all this collateral damage of these techniques as well, which makes them, in my opinion, highly questionable from an ethical point of view.
Well, it's Machiavellian, isn't it? The means justify the ends. And so if you have an end that you arbitrarily think is good and we need to get to, then you can do anything you want to get that end. No matter what you do to any people, and no matter how many human rights you take away, no matter how many fundamental freedoms you trample on, in the end, if you think, oh, well, I'm going to save a certain amount of lives, which you may think is a good cause, then you can destroy many, many more lives than the amount you're going to save in the process. I mean, the whole thing is really a completely perverse way of doing government. I mean, I think a far better way would be to rationalize with people, to trust people to make their own decisions, to reason with people, and then actually try to explain things on the basis of science and use a higher level, so you're engaging with people's conscious brains. And until we do that, we're never going to get anywhere as a species. We're going to keep going down into the roots of these like subconscious, you know, negative emotions like fear and guilt and shame, rather than elevating ourselves to reason, rationalism, and logic.
Yes, I totally agree. I think rational argument and transparent open debate is now a rare commodity. The government's more reliant on using these furtive methods of influence, which I think is highly questionable, has lots of collateral damage, and we do need to make these approaches known to more and more people so that we can hopefully show some dissent and sort of kickback about them, and have an open debate. You know, let's openly discuss these methods that the state are routinely using upon us, using our own taxpayers' money, of course, as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I totally agree with you. And you've been doing a lot of work into this. So, I mean, just quickly, we just got a minute or so before we go. Can you tell people, you know, where they can find your work and where they can inform themselves about the techniques that are being used on them so that they can recognize them when they see them and then block them out and then actually make their own decisions in their conscious brains?
Well, yes, I'm involved in quite a number of groups. You mentioned the smilefree.org. That is mask focus. But the thing about masks is that they strengthen these nudges. They perpetuate fear and guilt. So smilefree.org is one area. I'm also a member of HEART, the Health Advisory Recovery Team, which is heartteam.org. And I blog on coronababble.com. So I know it's a strange name, but hopefully memorable, coronababble.com. And I've got a number of articles about these particular nudging issues on there.
Fantastic. Gary, thank you so much for joining me on the show. And I think this has been a really, really important and valuable interview here. Do have a look at those websites and get informed so that you are not subject to the manipulation of the government and the tyrannical state. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there, providing hot meals, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Thanks for being a part of the David Curtin Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Two-tier policing has become a feature of policing in the UK. It's something I became aware of, first of all, in the Freedom Rallies in 2020. Before then, I was a big supporter of the police, but when I saw them charging an innocent, ordinary, everyday men and women gathered on Trafalgar Square to exercise their right to protest against the government's policies, I changed my mind, and I was a target of that just by virtue of being there and speaking on the stage. Well, I have with me now as my next guest, and I'm delighted to have on the show, Charles Mallett, who is a sometime contributor to UK Column, a former police detective, an active smallholder, and a former officer in the British Army. What a load of great things you've done, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David, and good morning all.
No, really good to see you. Look, we'll talk a little bit about policing, but then I think you're also concerned about defence as well. So we'll go and talk about that later on as well. But I mean, do you agree with the assessment that a lot of people are making now that there is two-tier policing, particularly, you know, where people look at what they're doing and they've seen, oh, look, they're taking the knee to Black Lives Matter protests. But then when there's a St. George's Day parade or a Freedom Rally, they go in, you know, really, really harshly and brutally against people.
Yeah, I do agree, I'm afraid. I think there's a lot more to it. And sadly, it's not just these high profile incidents where it does concern the sort of brutality that you're talking about. I think it's the sort of lazy everyday effect that sees this felt by the public. And really, similar to so many aspects of life, it's because the top part of any hierarchy, particularly police, is effectively a political beast. And this means that causes which subsequently play out in terms of police objectives or particular areas that they're going to concentrate on tend to be what might be regarded as progressive. And therefore, that filters down to some sort of operational practice, which means that there's a huge amount of bias inherent in the system. And of course, the trouble is now that so many police, despite the fact we hear that numbers are increasing and that this, that and the other capability has improved, actually the fact of it is that there are so many more obstacles in the path of an ordinary police constable these days that being able to step back and consider any situation objectively on its own merits is increasingly difficult. So I don't mean to sort of shift the blame away from police, because discretion should be used at the individual level. And frankly, it's not being, but there are quite compelling reasons why that's the case. But ultimately, this is a complete management failure, which is consistently pointed out in some means or other by the Inspectorate of Constabulary. But of course, nothing is actually ever done about it.
Hey, and that's a really good point, because when I've been on some of the Freedom Rallies and you've seen individual police constables behave in a way which I would think is absolutely terrible and inimical to their oath. A lot of people say, well, are you on your oath? Are you acting according to your oath? I mean, are they doing that? Do they have the right or freedom to do that? I mean, from what you've just said, it seems that the freedom to be an independent constable acting upon their oath and, you know, upholding the law independently as an independent citizen is gone. Is what's sort of going on in that area?
I think that having talked about a failure of management, I think that the sort of connectivity in the system is, it's terrible. It's very, very weak. Mm. And critically, at the lowest level, sort of the rank of sergeant, and again, this is a generalization, but it is one that I believe to be true and one that I certainly saw at first hand, there is a weakness and an inability and a reluctance to deal with exactly those sorts of things. So when you see an individual constable quite clearly not behaving with impartiality and quite clearly prosecuting an agenda, they are not dealt with in the way that they should be. And there are many reasons for that. A lot of it is the sort of the overlap of social and professional lives. But again, it's an integrity call. If people see their colleagues behaving like that, they should stop it. But unfortunately, they don't. And this is a great irony, because police are always talking about their code of ethics, and in particular the challenge system by which you're supposed to root this sort of stuff out. But I'm afraid it doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is because from above, it's not being stamped on.
Right. And we now have these police and crime commissioners as well. I mean, you've had them since 2012. David Cameron introduced them, and there are police and crime commissioner elections next week all over England and Wales. And do they have an effect in politicising the police, do you think?
I think they can do. I think that'll be that will depend upon the particular commissioner, whether or not they are, first of all, politically aligned and how they're politically aligned, and also what the feeling is within the constabulary. I mean, the relationship between the chief constable and the police and crime commissioner, of course, can be a very uneasy one. But I'm, you know, in effect, actually, they're more or less perpetuating the same thing. I mean, they should act as a necessary check and balance. But I don't really believe that that is actually the case. It's just another layer of bureaucracy that, frankly, isn't needed. Although I do put a slight caveat to that with the changes that have just been announced recently about on a disciplinary basis about giving chief constables the power to sort of act independently in terms of getting rid of employees. But you see, the trouble with that is that actually if you give that to the chief constable alone, it's only too easy for this to continue to be swept under the carpet and for it not to be observed from outside.
Indeed. There's an awful lot of things that need to be rectified, I think, with the police services and the police forces around the country. And, you know, you covered that very well. But let's move on, because another big thing that's been happening recently that we've also mentioned before is that there is going to be an increase in defence spending. Rishi Sunak announced that this week, up to 2.5% of GDP. But he also says the reason for doing this is because we need to combat the axis of authoritarian states, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, specifically mentioned. Now, in my view, I'm not against increasing spending to the armed forces because it's been run down over many, many years. But I think what they need to be doing is defending our own border in the English Channel rather than worrying about, you know, countries thousands and thousands of miles away. What do you make of this defence spending review and statements that have come out this week?
I think on the spending front, and that, you know, we've covered this a lot on UK Column, this is really simply lining the pockets of the military industrial complex to justify it. On a threat basis is, I'm afraid, completely disingenuous. These threats are not exactly fictitious, but they are certainly fabricated. They are being created by poking the various bears. And we've seen that most obviously with Russia and our part in not just precipitating what's happened in Ukraine, but the continued denial of any suing for peace. It's absolutely abhorrent. And the human side and the humanity of all of this has evaporated. That it's no longer really being considered in any way a noble discipline or pursuit, and that's a great stain. You know, that's for those that are involved in the day-to-day business of being in the armed forces. It's absolutely disgraceful that those that are shaping their daily activities and their operational commitments are behaving in this manner. But no, I mean, the on the money side of it, it's completely ridiculous. There's a deficit now. The government committee responsible for this declared that there's a $16.9 billion deficit in MOD spending. Essentially, they're accusing the armed forces of not being able to run their accounts properly and not be able to budget for kit. At the same time, I mean, that came out, you know, barely a couple of weeks before the Prime Minister announced yet again another record-breaking lethal aid package to Ukraine. I mean, there are billions and billions going to a conflict which is simply destroying lives and destroying large parts of the countryside, as well as destroying any goodwill towards the West.
It's been a disaster, hasn't it? I mean, from the very beginning. And what I thought was absolutely appalling was there was a peace deal on the table in April 2022, 2 months after the start of the special military operation. And Boris Johnson went over, spoke to Zelensky, and then that peace deal was scuppered. And since then, we're here 2 years on, and half a million young Ukrainian men have died. And it doesn't seem like there's any will, any way that the Western leaders are got or even thinking about to stop this conflict. I mean, they're just going on and on. Now they're talking about troops on the ground in Ukraine. You've got French troops in Odessa. Britain sending, as you say, another half a billion pounds of lethal aid. Is there any way we can stop this from continuing?
It's very hard to see how, because much like the police, the hierarchy, military hierarchy, is also political. Unfortunately, it becomes so, and also they're forward thinking. They look, when I mean individually, personally, they look to jobs that they're going to be considering once they enter civvy street. So that's part of it. Also, part of it, of course, is that those that are generals or admirals or the like now grew up on Cold War doctrine. They have some operational experience in the sort of medium-sized operational theatres of the 1990s and 2000s, but ultimately they're going back to the great Russian bear being the threat. And it is extraordinary that after, you know, more than 100 years since the First World War, we're essentially looking at conflict in terms of a war of attrition. So that is despicable. Despicable still is the politicians who are putting soldiers forward for this, of course, risking absolutely nothing themselves. You know, with every tweet that Grant Shapps fires out, he retreats further behind his sofa. And that is also horrific. Of course, when we think about it in terms of the overall planning and what may drop out of it, and we think about, say, a comparison with the COVID spectacle, which of course was apparently a desire to unite in the face of a common enemy, but in actual fact, the freedoms that were ceded by people under that banner were enormous, and it looks very much like it's going to be the same thing with this. This will destroy the country financially, which was already, of course, in a very, very precarious position. And if you look at Russia and Ukraine, both are now introducing digital currencies and digital ID using war as a pretext. So I think that's one of the spaces to be watched.
Right, you think that this may bring in a new sort of martial law regime where we'll have digital IDs and so on? Is that sort of that's a frightening thing, isn't it? And I already hear that, you know, added to the conscription narrative that is being started up. It started up at the beginning this year for the first time. People started talking about, oh, we need to get more people in the army, perhaps send them over to fight in Ukraine. I mean, do you think there's anything to this narrative of conscription, or is this just something to soften us up for keeping us involved in this conflict and war in Ukraine for a long time?
It sounds very much like a sort of PR push. I mean, I can't really see it happening. And I mean, you know, beware the law of unintended consequences, because of course the other issue that the armed forces has confronted, first of all, on the recruitment and retention front, by introducing all these diversity measures and essentially going woke, they have lost the ability to both recruit but also to retain. And so manning even now is challenging. How you're going to inflate that and not see people actively sort of running for the hills where conscription's concerned, I'm not sure. But no, I mean, again, for what? What is the purpose of that, really? Because there is no way in which, even if we conscripted every single eligible male and female of fighting age, to match any of the threats you've talked about, Russia or Iran or China, it's pie in the sky.
Yeah, quite. I mean, the idea that we're going to go and stand up militarily to China is just absolutely preposterous, isn't it? But, you know, I think, you know, young people today would be looking at this and thinking, well, Who am I fighting for? If I join the army, what am I fighting for? They're going to kill Russians, or they're going to kill Palestinians, or they're going to kill Iranians. And they're fighting for King Charles and David Cameron and Rishi Sunak and Grant Shapps. I don't think any of those characters are in the least bit inspiring and the least bit worth even giving 1 ounce of energy for. You think that young people are looking at them and thinking, look, I've got no pride. There's nothing here for me to fight for, because the army, the navy, the air force is not actually standing for my country anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think the days of king country are long gone. I think the idea that anyone would be fighting for Shapps or Sunak or Cameron is a fantasy. But I think the reality is they are fighting for global corporate interests, and that is, you know, as Julian Assange said in 2011, and it never grows tired. You know, it's not about a successful war; it's about an endless war. And he was absolutely correct then, and he's absolutely correct now. So, yeah, I think at the individual level, it's terribly, terribly disappointing, because people join the armed forces in good faith and they are let down by everybody that sticks their oar in.
It's an absolute tragedy, because we have a wonderful military past. They've done some good things in the past. Obviously, you know, the Second World War, that was stopped National Socialism and so on. But now the end of the Cold War is here, and there doesn't seem to have been any kind of change in thinking. And so it's very, very dangerous when this idea that there's a Western bloc that is forming against an Eastern bloc, and we need to fight them until the cows come home, really is going to lead us into a very, very difficult situation if we don't get out of it. I mean, we certainly have got to avoid getting into World War III, which some people seem to want. And the only people who are going to win from this are the shareholders and owners of companies in the military industrial complex and warmongers and people who make money from manufacturing arms. And the world is not going to be a safer place. Charles Mallett, thank you so much for joining me on today's News Talk to talk about these issues. And it'll be great to have you back again sometime, because you are full of knowledge about many things. Thanks for also to you viewers for joining us on today's News Talk, TNT.